it going to be? The rat told him. Then Old Bailey put the rat in his pocket and climbed over the side of the building. Sitting on the ledge beside the sewer, in his plastic lawn chair, Danikin was overcome by a presentiment of wealth and prosperity. He could feel it drifting from west to east towards them. He clapped his hands loudly. Other men ran to him, and the women and the children, seizing hooks and nets and lines as they did so. They assembled along the slippery sewer ledge in the sputtering green light of their lanterns. Danikin pointed, and they waited, in silence, which is how the sewer folk wait. The body of the Marquis de Carabas came floating face down along the sewer, the current carrying him slow and stately as a funeral barge. They pulled it in with their hooks and their nets, in silence, and soon had it up on the ledge. They removed the coat, the boots, the gold pocket watch, and the contents of the coat pockets, although they left the rest of the clothes on the corpse. Danikin beamed at the loot. He clapped again, and the sewer folk began to ready themselves for the market. Now they truly had something of value to sell. "Are you sure the Marquis will be at the market?" Richard asked Dor, as the path began, slowly, to climb. "He won't let us down," she said, as confidently as she could. "I'm sure he'll be there." Chapter 14 HMS Belfast is a gunship of 11,000 tons, commissioned in 1939. Which saw active service in the Second World War. Since then, it has been moored on the south bank of the Thames, in postcard land, between Tower Bridge and London Bridge, opposite the Tower of London. From its deck, one can see St. Paul's Cathedral, and the gilt top of the column-like monument to the Great Fire of London, erected, as so much of London was erected, by Christopher Wren. The ship serves as a floating museum, as a memorial, as a training ground. There is a walkway onto the ship from the shore, and they came down the walkway in their twos and threes and in their dozens. They set up their stalls as early as they could, all the tribes of London below, united both by the market truce and by a mutual desire to pitch their own stalls as far as possible from the sewer folk stall. It had been agreed well over a century before that the sewer folk could only set up a stall at those markets held in the open air. Danikin and his folk dumped their booty in a large pile on a rubber sheet beneath a large gun tower. Nobody ever came to the sewer folk's stall immediately, but towards the end of the market they would come, the bargain hunters, the curious, and those few fortunate individuals blessed with no sense of smell. Richard and Hunter and Dor pushed their way through the crowds on the deck. Richard realized that he had somehow lost the need to stop and stare. The people here were no less strange than at the last floating market, but, he supposed, he was every bit as strange to them, wasn't he? He looked around, scanning the faces in the crowd as they walked, hunting for the Marquis's ironic smile. "I don't see him," he said. They were approaching a smith's stall, where a man who could easily have passed for a small mountain, if one were to overlook the shaggy brown beard, tossed a lump of red molten metal from a brazier onto an anvil. Richard had never seen a real anvil before. He could feel the heat from the molten metal and the brazier from a dozen feet away. "Keep looking. De Carabas will turn up," said Dor, looking behind them. "Like a bad penny." She thought for a moment, and added, "What exactly is a bad penny, anyway?" And then, before Richard could answer, she squealed, "Hammersmith!" The bearded mountain man looked up, stopped hitting the molten metal, and roared, "By the temple and the arch, Lady Dor!" Then he picked her up as if she weighed no more than a mouse. "Hello, Hammersmith," said Dor. "I hoped you'd be here."
"Never miss a market, lady!" he thundered cheerfully. Then he confided,
like an explosion with a secret. "This is where the business is, you see. Now," he said, recollecting the cooling lump of metal on his anvil, "just you wait here a moment." He put door down at eye level on the top of his booth, 7 feet above the deck. He banged the lump of metal with his hammer, twisting it as he did so with implements Richard assumed, correctly, were tongs. Under the hammer blows, it changed from a shapeless blob of orange metal into a perfect black rose. It was a work of astonishing delicacy, each petal perfect and distinct. Hammersmith dipped the rose into a bucket of cold water beside the anvil. It hissed and steamed. Then he pulled it out of the bucket, wiped it, and handed it to a fat man in chainmail who was standing patiently to one side. The fat man professed himself well satisfied and gave Hammersmith, in return, a green plastic Marks and Spencer shopping bag filled with various kinds of cheese. "Hammersmith," said Dorr from her perch, "these are my friends." Hammersmith enveloped Richard's hand in one several sizes up. His handshake was enthusiastic but very gentle, as if he had, in the past, had a number of accidents shaking hands and had practiced it until he got it right. "Chond!" he boomed. "Richard," said Richard. Hammersmith looked delighted. "Richard! Fine name! I had a horse called Richard!" He let go of Richard's hand, turned to Hunter and said, "And you are Hunter? Hunter! As I live, breathe, and defecate, it is!" Hammersmith blushed, like a schoolboy. He spat on his hand and attempted, awkwardly, to plaster his hair back. Then he stuck his hand out and realized that he had just spat on it, and he wiped it on his leather apron and shifted his weight from foot to foot. "Hammersmith?" said Hunter, with a perfect caramel smile. "Hammersmith?" asked Dorr. "Will you help me down?" He looked shamefaced.
"Beg pardon, lady,"
he said, and lifted her down. It came to Richard then that Hammersmith had known Dorr as a small child, and he found himself feeling unaccountably jealous of the huge man.
"Now," Hammersmith was saying to Dorr, "what can I do for you?"
"Couple of things," she said, "but first of all," she turned to Richard. "Richard, I've got a job for you." Hunter raised an eyebrow. "For him?" Dorr nodded. "For both of you. Will you go and find us some food, please?" Richard felt oddly proud. He had proved himself in the ordeal. He was one of them. He would go and he would bring back food. He puffed out his chest. "I am your bodyguard. I stay by your side," said Hunter. Dorr grinned. Her opal-colored eyes flashed. "In the market? It's okay, Hunter. Market truce holds. No one's going to touch me here. And Richard needs looking after more than I do." Richard deflated, but no one was watching. "And what if someone violated the truce?" asked Hunter. Hammersmith shivered, despite the heat of his brazier.
"Violate the market truce? Brrr!"
"It's not going to happen. Go on, both of you. Curry, please. And get me some poppadoms, please. Spicy ones." Hunter ran her hand through her hair. And then she turned and walked off into the crowd, and Richard went with her. "So what would happen if someone violated market truce?" asked Richard, as they pushed through the crowds. She thought about this for a moment. "The last time it happened was about 300 years ago. A couple of friends got into an argument over a woman in the market. A knife was pulled and one of them died. The other fled." "What happened to him? Was he killed?" Hunter shook her head. "Quite the opposite. He still wishes he had been the one to have died." "He's still alive?" Hunter pursed her lips. "Ish," she said after a while. "Alive-ish." A moment passed. "Phew," Richard said, thinking he was going to be ill. "What's that? That stink?" sewer folk. Richard averted his head and tried not to breathe through his nose until they were well away from the sewer folk's stall. "Any sign of the Marquis yet?" he asked. Hunter shook her head. She could have reached out her hand and touched him. They went up a gangplank toward the food stalls and more welcoming aromas. Old Bailey found the sewer folk with little difficulty, following his nose. He knew what he had to do, and he took a certain pleasure in making a bit of a performance of it, ostentatiously examining the dead cocker spaniel, the artificial leg, and the damp and mouldering portable telephone, and shaking his head dolorously at each of them. And then he made a point of noticing the Marquis's body. He scratched his nose. He put on his spectacles and peered at it. He nodded to himself glumly, hoping to give the vague impression of being a man in need of a corpse who was disappointed by the selection but was going to have to make do with what they had. And then he beckoned to Dunnikin and pointed to the corpse. Dunnikin opened his hands wide, smiled beatifically, and gazed up towards the heavens, conveying the bliss with which the Marquis's remains had entered their life. He put a hand to his forehead, lowered it, and looked devastated, in order to convey the tragedy that losing such a remarkable corpse would be. Old Bailey put a hand in his pocket and produced a half-used stick of deodorant. He handed it to Dunnikin, who squinted at it, licked it, and handed it back, unimpressed. Old Bailey pocketed it. He looked back at the corpse of the Marquis de Carabas, half-dressed, barefoot, still damp from its journey through the sewers. The body was ashen, drained of blood from many cuts, small and large, and the skin was wrinkled and prune-like from its time in the water. Then he pulled out a bottle, three-quarters filled with a yellow liquid, and passed it to Dunnikin. Dunnikin looked at it suspiciously. The sewer folk know what a bottle of Chanel No. 5 looks like. And they gathered around Dunnikin, staring. Carefully, self-importantly, he unscrewed the top of the bottle and dabbed the tiniest amount on his wrist. Then, with a gravity the finest Parisian parfumier would have envied, Dunnikin sniffed. Then he nodded his head enthusiastically and approached Old Bailey to embrace him and conclude the deal. The old man averted his face and held his breath until the embrace was concluded. Old Bailey held up one finger and tried his best to mime that he was not so young as once he was, and that, dead or not, the Marquis de Carabas was a bit on the heavy side. Dunnikin picked his nose thoughtfully, and then, with a hand gesture indicating not only magnanimity, but also a foolish and misplaced generosity that would obviously send him, Dunnikin, and the rest of the sewer folk to the poorhouse, he had one of the younger sewer folk tie the corpse to the bottom half of the old perambulator. The old roof man covered the body with a cloth, and he pulled it away from the sewer folk across the crowded deck.
One portion of vegetable curry, please, said Richard to the woman at the curry stall. And, I was wondering, the meat curry, what kind of meat is it then?
The woman told him.
Oh, said Richard, right. Just better make that vegetable curries all round.
Hello again, said a rich voice beside him. It was the pale woman they had met in the caves, with the black dress and the foxglove-coloured eyes.
Hello, said Richard, with a smile. Oh, and some poppadoms, please. You, here for curry?
She fixed him with her violet eyes and said, in mock Bela Lugosi,
I do not eat curry.
And then she laughed. A lavish, delighted laugh, and Richard found himself realizing how long it had been since he had shared a joke with a woman.
Oh, Richard Mayhew.
He stuck out his hand. She touched it with her own hand, in something a little like a handshake. Her fingers were very cold, but then, late at night, at the end of autumn, on a ship out on the Thames, Everything is very cold. Lamia, she said. I'm a velvet.
Ah, he said, right. Are there a lot of you?
A few, she said. Richard collected the containers with the curry in.
What do you do? He asked.
When I'm not looking for food, she said with a smile, I'm a guide. I know every inch of the underside.
Hunter, who Richard could have sworn was over on the other side of the stall, was standing next to Lamia. She said,
he's not yours.
Lamia smiled sweetly.
I'll be the judge of that, she said.
Richard said, Hunter, this is Lamia. She's a Velcro.
Velvet,
corrected Lamia sweetly. She's a guide.
I'll take you wherever you want to go.
Hunter took the bag with the food in it from Richard. Time to go back, she said.
Well, said Richard, if we're off to see the you-know-what, maybe she could help.
Hunter said nothing. Instead, she looked at Richard. Had she looked at him that way the day before, he would have dropped the subject. But that was then.
Let's see what Dor thinks, said Richard. Any sign of the Marquis?
Not yet, said Hunter.
Old Bailey had dragged the corpse down the gangplank tied to its pram base, like a ghastly Guy Fawkes, one of the effigies that not so very long ago the children of London had wheeled and dragged around in early November, displaying to passers-by before their flaming demise on the bonfires of the 5th of November, bonfire night. He pulled the corpse over Tower Bridge, and, muttering and complaining, he hauled it up the hill past the Tower of London. He made his way west, towards Tower Hill Station, and stopped a little before the station, beside a large grey jut of wall. It wasn't a roof, thought Old Bailey, but it would do. It was one of the last remnants of the London Wall. The London Wall, according to tradition, was built on the orders of the Roman Emperor Constantine the Great in the 3rd century AD at the request of his mother, Helena, who was actually from London and was sick of potentates and civic leaders from all over the empire mentioning to her in an offhanded manner how big the city walls were where they came from and asking what the city walls were like in her part of the world. When it was finished, it had enclosed the small city completely. It was 30 feet high and 8 feet wide and was, unarguably, the London Wall. It was no longer 30 feet high, the ground level having risen since Constantine's mother's day. Most of the original London Wall is 15 feet below street level today. And it no longer enclosed the city, but it was still an imposing lump of wall. Old Bailey nodded vigorously to himself. He fastened a length of rope to the pram base, and he scrambled up the wall. Then, grunting and bless me-ing, he hauled the Marquis up to the top of the wall. He untied the body from the pram wheels and laid it gently out on its back, arms at its side. There were wounds on the body that were still oozing. It was very dead.
You stupid bugger, whispered Old Bailey, sadly. What did you want to get yourself killed for anyway?
The moon was bright and small and high in the cold night, and autumn constellations speckled the blue-black sky like the dust of crushed diamonds. A nightingale fluttered onto the wall, examined the corpse of the Marquis de Carabas, and chirruped sweetly.
None of your beak, said Old Bailey gruffly. You birds don't smell like flipping roses neither.
It chirped a melodious nightingale obscenity at him, and flew off into the night. Old Bailey reached into his pocket and pulled out the black rat, who had gone to sleep. It stared about it sleepily, then yawned, displaying a vast and ratty expanse of piebald tongue.
Personally, said Old Bailey to the black rat, I'll be happy if I never smell anything ever again.
He put it down by his feet on the stones of London Wall, and it chittered at him and gestured with its front paws. Old Bailey sighed. Carefully, he took the silver box out from his pocket, and from an inner pocket he pulled the toasting fork. He placed the silver box on De Carabas's chest. Then, nervously, he reached out the toasting fork and flipped open the lid of the box. Inside the silver box, on a nest of red velvet, was a large duck's egg. Pale blue-green in the moonlight. Old Bailey raised the toasting fork, screwed up his eyes, and smashed the egg. There was a whoop as it imploded. There was a great stillness for several seconds after that. Then the wind began. It had no direction, but seemed somehow to be coming from everywhere. A swirling, sudden gale. Fallen leaves, newspaper pages, all the city's detritus blew up from the ground and was driven through the air. The wind touched the surface of the Thames and carried the cold water into the sky in a fine and driving spray. It was a mad wind, a dangerous, crazy wind. The stallholders on the deck of the Belfast cursed it and clutched their possessions to stop them blowing away. And then, when it seemed that the wind would become so strong it would blow the world away and blow the stars away and send the people tumbling through the air like so many desiccated autumn leaves, just then, it was over. And the leaves and the papers and the plastic shopping bags tumbled to the earth and the road and the water. High on the remnant of the London Wall, the silence that followed the wind was, in its way, as loud as the wind had been. It was broken by a cough, a horrid, wet coughing. This was followed by the sound of someone awkwardly rolling over, and then the sound of someone being terribly and obscenely sick. The Marquis de Carabas vomited sewer water over the side of the London Wall, staining the grey stones with brown foulness. It took a long time to purge the water from his body. And then he said, in a hoarse voice that was little more than a grinding whisper, "I think my throat's been cut. Have you anything to bind it with?" Old Bailey fumbled in his pockets and pulled out a grubby length of cloth. He passed it to the Marquis, who wrapped it around his throat a few times and then tied it tight. Old Bailey found himself reminded, incongruously, of the high-wrapped Beau Brummel collars of the Regency dandies. "Anything to drink?" croaked the Marquis. Old Bailey pulled out his hip flask and unscrewed the top and passed it to the Marquis, who swigged back a mouthful, then winced with pain and coughed weakly. The Black Rat, who had watched all this with interest, now began to climb down the fragment of wall and away. It would tell the Golden. All favours had been repaid. All debts were done. The Marquis gave Old Bailey back his hip flask. Old Bailey put it away. "How are ye feeling?" he asked. "I've felt better." The Marquis sat up, shivering. His nose was running and his eyes flickered about. He was staring at the world as if he had never seen it before. "What did you have to go and get yourself killed for anyway? That's what I want to know," asked Old Bailey. "Information," whispered the Marquis. "People tell you so much more when they know you're just about to be dead. And then they talk around you when you are." "Then you found out what you wanted to know?" The Marquis fingered the wounds in his arms and his legs. "Oh, yes, most of it. I have more than an inkling of what this affair is actually about." Then he closed his eyes once more and wrapped his arms about himself and swayed slowly back and forth.
"What's it like, then?" asked Old Bailey. "Being dead?"
The Marquis sighed. And then he twisted his lips up into a smile, and with a glitter of his old self, he replied,
"Live long enough, Old Bailey, and you can find out for yourself."
Old Bailey looked disappointed.
"Bastard, after all I'd done to bring you back from that dread bourne from which there is no returning."
"Well, usually no returning." The Marquis de Carabas looked up at him. His eyes were very white in the moonlight, and he whispered,
"What's it like being dead?"
"It's very cold, my friend. Very dark and very cold." Dor held up the chain. The silver key hung from it, red and orange in the light of Hammersmith's brazier. She smiled.
"Fine work, Hammersmith."
"Thank you, lady."
She hung the chain around her neck and hid the key away inside her layers of clothes.
"What would you like in return?"
The smith looked abashed.
"I hardly want to presume upon your good nature," he mumbled.
Dor made her get on with it face. He bent down and produced a black box from beneath a pile of metalworking tools. It was made of dark wood, inlaid with ivory and mother-of-pearl, and was the size of a large dictionary. He turned it over and over in his hands.
"It's a puzzle box," he explained. "I took it in return for some smithing a handful of years back. I can't get it to open, though I've tried ever so."
Dor took the box and ran her fingers over the smooth surface.
"I'm not surprised you haven't been able to open it. The mechanism's all jammed. It's completely fused shut."
Hammersmith looked glum.
"So I'll never find out what's in it."
Dor made an amused face. Her fingers explored the surface of the box. A rod slid out of the side of the box. She half pushed the rod back into the box, then twisted. There was a clunk from deep inside it, and a door opened in the side.
"Here,"
said Dor.
"My lady,"
said Hammersmith. He took the box from her and pulled the door open all the way. There was a drawer inside the box, which he pulled open. The small toad in the drawer croaked and looked about itself with copper eyes, incuriously. Hammersmith's face fell.
"I was hoping it would be diamonds and pearls," he said.
Dor reached out a hand and stroked the toad's head.
"He's got pretty eyes," she said.
"Keep him, Hammersmith. He'll bring you luck. And thank you again. I know I can rely on your discretion."
"You can rely on me, lady,"
said Hammersmith earnestly. They sat together on the top of the London Wall, not speaking. Old Bailey slowly lowered the pram wheels to the ground below them.
"Where's the market?"
asked the Marquis.
Old Bailey pointed to the gunship.
"Over there."
"Dor and the others, they'll be expecting me."
"You aren't in any condition to go anywhere."
The Marquis coughed painfully. It sounded, to Old Bailey, like there was still plenty of sewer in his lungs.
"I've made a long enough journey today,"
de Carabas whispered.
"A little farther won't hurt."
He examined his hands, flexed the fingers slowly, as if to see whether or not they would do as he wished. And then he twisted his body around and began, awkwardly, to climb down the side of the wall. But before he did so, he said, hoarsely and perhaps a little sadly,
"It would seem, Old Bailey, that I owe you a favour."
When Richard returned with the curries, Dor ran to him and threw her arms around him. She hugged him tightly and even patted his bottom before seizing the paper bag from him and pulling it open with enthusiasm. She took a container of vegetable curry and began happily to eat.
"Thanks,"
said Dor with her mouth full.
"Any sign of the Marquis yet?"
"None," said Hunter.
"Croup and Vandemar?"
"No."
"Yummy curry. This is really good."
"You got the chain all right?" asked Richard. Dor pulled the chain up from around her neck, enough to show it was there, and she let it fall again, the weight of the key pulling it back down.
"Dor," said Richard, "this is Lamia. She's a guide. She says she can take us anywhere in the underside."
"Anywhere?" Dor munched a poppadom.
"Anywhere," said Lamia.
Dor put her head on one side.
"Do you know where the Angel Islington is?"
Lamia blinked slowly, long lashes covering and revealing her foxglove-colored eyes.
"Islington," she said.
"You can't go there."
"Do you know?"
"Down Street," said Lamia. "The end of Down Street. But it's not safe." Hunter had been watching this conversation, arms folded and unimpressed. Now she said, "We don't need a guide."
"Well," said Richard, "I think we do. The Marquis isn't around anywhere. We know it's going to be a dangerous journey. We have to get the thing I got to the Angel. And then he'll tell Dor about her family, and he'll tell me how to get home."
Lamia looked up at Hunter with delight.
"And he can give you brains," she said cheerfully, "and me a heart."
Dor wiped the last of the curry from her bowl with her fingers and licked them.
"We'll be fine, just the three of us, Richard. We cannot afford a guide."
Lamia bridled.
"I'll take my payment from him, not you."
"And what payment would your kind demand?" asked Hunter.
"That," said Lamia, with a sweet smile, "is for me to know and him to wonder."
Dor shook her head.
"I really don't think so."
Richard snorted.
"You just don't like it that I'm sorting everything out for once instead of following blindly behind you, going where I'm told."
"Oh, that's not it at all." Richard turned to Hunter.
"Well, Hunter, do you know the way to Islington?"
Hunter shook her head.
Dor sighed. "We should get a move on. Down Street, you say?"
Lamia smiled with plum-coloured lips.
"Yes, lady."
By the time the Marquis reached the market, they were gone. Chapter 15. They walked off the ship, down the long gangplank and onto the shore, where they went down some steps, through a long unlit underpass, and up again. Lamia strode confidently ahead of them. She brought them out in a small, cobbled alley. Gas lights burned and sputtered on the walls.
"Third door along," she said.
They stopped in front of the door. There was a brass plate on it which said, "The Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Houses." And beneath that, in smaller letters, "Down Street. Please knock."
"You get to the street through the house?" asked Richard.
"No," said Lamia. "The street is in the house." Richard knocked on the door. Nothing happened. They waited, and they shivered from the early morning cold. Richard knocked again. Finally, he rang the doorbell. The door was opened by a sleepy-looking footman wearing a powdered, crooked wig and scarlet livery. He looked at the motley rabble on his doorstep with an expression that indicated that they had not been worth getting out of bed for.
"Can I help you?" said the footman.
Richard had been told to fuck off and die with more warmth and good humour.
"Down Street," said Lamia imperiously.
"This way," sighed the footman. "If you'll wipe your feet."
They walked through an impressive lobby. Then they waited while the footman lit each of the candles on a candelabra, of the sort normally only seen on paperback book covers, where it is traditionally clutched by a young lady in a flowing nightdress who is fleeing from the kind of manor house that only has one light on anywhere, burning in an attic window. They went down some impressive, richly carpeted stairs. They went down a flight of less impressive, less richly carpeted stairs. They went down a flight of entirely unimpressive stairs carpeted in a threadbare brown sacking, and finally they went down a flight of drab wooden stairs with no carpet on them at all. At the bottom of those stairs was an antique service elevator with a sign on it. The sign said, "Out of order." The footman ignored the sign and pulled open the wire outer door with a metallic thud. Lamia thanked him, politely, and stepped into the elevator. The others followed. The footman turned his back on them. Richard watched him through the wire mesh, clutching his candelabra, going back up the wooden stairs. There was a short row of black buttons on the wall of the elevator. Lamia pressed the bottommost button. The metal lattice door closed automatically with a bang. A motor engaged, and the elevator began slowly, creakily, to descend. The four of them stood close-packed in the elevator. Richard realized that he could smell each of the women in the elevator with him. Dor smelled mostly of curry. Hunter smelled, not unpleasantly, of sweat, in a way that made him think of great cats in cages at zoos, while Lamia smelled intoxicatingly of honeysuckle and lily of the valley and musk. The elevator continued to descend. Richard was sweating in a clammy cold sweat and digging his fingernails deep into his palms. In the most conversational tones he could muster, he said, "Now would be a very bad time to discover that one was claustrophobic, wouldn't it?" "Yes," said Dor. "Then I won't," said Richard. And they went down. Finally, there was a jerk and a clunk and a ratcheting noise, and the elevator stopped. Hunter pulled open the door, looked about, and then stepped out onto a narrow ledge. Richard looked out of the open elevator door. They were hanging in the air, at the top of something that reminded Richard of a painting he had once seen of the Tower of Babel, or rather, of how the Tower of Babel in the painting might have looked, were it inside out. It was an enormous and ornate spiral path, carved out of rock, which went down and down around a central well. Lights flickered dimly here and there in the walls, beside the paths, and far, far below them, tiny fires were burning. It was at the top of the central well, a few thousand feet above solid ground, that the elevator was hanging. It swayed a little. Richard took a deep breath and followed the others onto the wooden ledge. Then, although he knew it was a bad idea, he looked down. There was nothing but a wooden board between him and the rock floor thousands of feet below. There was a long plank stretched between the ledge on which they stood and the top of the rocky path, 20 feet away. "And I suppose," he said, with a great deal less insouciance than he imagined, "this wouldn't be a good time to point out that I'm really crap at heights." "It's safe," said Lamia, "or it was the last time I was here. Watch." She walked across the board, a rustle of black velvet. She could have balanced a dozen books on her head and never dropped one. When she reached the stone path at the side, she stopped and turned and smiled at them encouragingly. Hunter followed her across, then turned and waited beside her on the edge. "See?" said Dor. She reached out a hand, squeezed Richard's arm. "It's fine." Richard nodded and swallowed. "Fine." Dor walked across. She did not seem to be enjoying herself. But she crossed, nonetheless. The three women waited for Richard, who stood there. Richard noticed, after a while, that he did not seem to be starting to walk across the wooden plank, despite any "walk" commands he sent to his legs. Far above them, a button was pressed. Richard heard the thunk and the distant grinding of an elderly electric motor. The door of the elevator slammed closed behind him, leaving Richard standing, precariously, on a narrow wooden platform, no wider than a plank itself.
"Richard!" shouted Dor. "Move!"
The elevator began to ascend. Richard stepped off the shaking platform and onto the wooden board. Then his legs turned to jelly beneath him, and he found himself on all fours on the plank, holding on for dear life. There was a tiny, rational part of his mind that wondered about the elevator, who had called it back up and why. The rest of his mind, however, was engaged in telling all his limbs to clutch the plank rigidly, and in screaming at the top of its mental voice, "I don't want to die!" Richard closed his eyes as tightly as he could, certain that if he opened them and saw the rock wall below him, he would simply let go of the plank and fall, and fall, and... "I'm not scared of falling," he told himself. "The bit I'm scared of is the bit where you stop falling and start being dead." But he knew he was lying to himself. It was the fall he was scared of, afraid of flailing and tumbling helplessly through the air down to the rock floor far below, knowing there was nothing he could do to save himself, no miracle that would save him. He slowly became aware that someone was talking to him. "Just climb along the plank, Richard," someone was saying.
"I can't," he whispered.
"You went through worse than this to get the key, Richard," someone said. It was Dor talking.
"I'm really not very good at heights," he said obstinately, his face pressed against the wooden board, his teeth chattering.
"Then I want to go home." He felt the wood of the plank pressing against his face, and then the plank began to shake. Hunter's voice said, "I'm really not sure how much weight the board will bear. You two, put your weight here." The plank vibrated as someone moved along it towards him. He clung to it with his eyes closed. Then Hunter said, quietly, confidently, in his ear, "Richard?"
"Hmm?"
"Just edge forward, Richard. A bit at a time. Come on." Her caramel fingers stroked his white-knuckled hand, clasping the plank. "Come on." He took a deep breath and inched forward and froze again.
"You're doing fine," said Hunter. "That's good. Come on."
And inch by inch, creep by crawl, she talked Richard along the plank. And then at the end of the plank, she simply picked him up, her hands beneath his arms, and placed him on solid ground.
"Thank you," he said. He could not think of anything else to say to Hunter that would be big enough to cover what she had just done for him.
He said it again.
"Thank you."
And then he said to all of them, "I'm sorry." Dor looked up at him.
"It's okay," she said. "You're safe now."
Richard looked at the winding spiral road beneath the world, going down and down. And he looked at Hunter and Dor and Lamia, and he laughed until he wept.
"What?"
Dor demanded, when at length he had stopped laughing.
"Is so funny."
"Safe," he said simply. Dor stared at him, and then she too smiled.
"So where do we go now?"
Richard asked.
"Down,"
said Lamia. They began to walk down street. Hunter was in the lead, with Dor beside her. Richard walked next to Lamia, breathing in the lily-of-the-valley honeysuckle scent of her, and enjoying her company.
"I really appreciate you coming with us," he told her, "being a guide. I hope it's not going to be bad luck for you or anything."
She fixed him with her foxglove-colored eyes.
"Why should it be bad luck? Do you know who the rat speakers are?"
"Of course."
"There was a rat speaker girl named Anesthesia. She, well, we got to be sort of friends a bit, and she
was guiding me somewhere, and then she got stolen on Knight's Bridge. I keep wondering what happened to her. She smiled at him, sympathetically. My people have stories about that. Some of them may even be true. You'll have to tell me about them, he said. It was cold. His breath was steaming in the chilly air. One day, she said. Her breath did not steam. It's very good of you, taking me with you. Least we could do. Dor and Hunter went around the curve in front of them and were lost to sight. You know, said Richard, the other two are getting a bit ahead of us. We might want to hurry. Let them go, she said gently. We'll catch up. It was, thought Richard, peculiarly like going to a movie with a girl as a teenager. Or rather, like walking home afterwards, stopping at bus shelters or beside walls to snatch a kiss, a hasty fumble of skin and a tangle of tongues, then hurrying on to catch up with your mates and her friends. Lamia ran a cold finger down his cheek. You're so warm, she said admiringly. It must be wonderful to have so much warmth. Richard tried to look modest. It's not something I think about much, really, he admitted. He heard, distantly, from above, the metallic slam of the elevator door. Lamia looked up at him, pleadingly, sweetly. Would you give me some of your heat, Richard? She asked. I'm so cold. Richard wondered if he should kiss her. What? She looked disappointed. Don't you like me? She asked. He hoped desperately that he had not hurt her feelings. Of course I like you, he heard his voice saying. You're very nice. And you aren't using all your heat, are you? She pointed out reasonably. I suppose not. And you said you'd pay me for being your guide. And it's what I want, as my payment. Warmth. Can I have some? Anything she wanted. Anything. The honeysuckle and the lily of the valley wrapped around him, and his eyes saw nothing but her pale skin and her dark plum-bloom lips and her jet-black hair. He nodded. Somewhere inside him, something was screaming, but whatever it was, it could wait. She reached up her hands to his face and pulled it gently down towards her, and then she kissed him, long and languorously. There was a moment of initial shock at the chill of her lips and the cold of her tongue, and then he succumbed to her kiss entirely. After some time, she pulled back. He could feel the ice on his lips. He stumbled back against the wall. He tried to blink, but his eyes felt as if they were frozen open. She looked up at him and smiled delightedly. Her skin was flushed and pink, and her lips were scarlet. Her breath steamed in the cold air. She licked her red lips with a warm crimson tongue. His world began to go dark. He thought he saw a black shape at the edge of his vision. More, she said, and she reached out to him. He watched the velvet pull Richard to her for the first kiss, watched the rime and the frost spread over Richard's skin. He watched her pull back happily, and then he walked up behind her, and as she moved in to finish what she had begun, he reached out and seized her hard by the neck and lifted her off the ground. Give it back, he rasped in her ear. Give him back his life. The velvet reacted like a kitten who had just been dropped into a bathtub, wriggling and hissing and spitting and scratching. It did her no good. She was held tight by the throat. You can't make me,
she said in decidedly unmusical tones. He increased the pressure.
"Give him his life back,"
he told her, hoarsely and honestly,
"or I'll break your neck."
She winced. He pushed her towards Richard, frozen and crumpled against the rock wall. She took Richard's hand and breathed into his nose and mouth. Vapor came from her mouth and trickled into his. The ice on his skin began to thaw, the rime on his hair to vanish. He squeezed her neck again.
"All of it, Lamia."
She hissed then, extremely grudgingly, and opened her mouth once more. A final puff of steam drifted from her mouth to his and vanished inside him. Richard blinked. The ice on his eyes had melted to tears and were running down his cheeks.
"What did you do to me?"
he asked.
"She was drinking your life,"
said the Marquis de Carabas, in a hoarse whisper.
"Taking your warmth, turning you into a cold thing, like her."
Lamia's face twisted like a tiny child deprived of a favorite toy. Her foxglove eyes flashed.
"I need it more than he does,"
she wailed.
"I thought you liked me,"
said Richard, stupidly. The Marquis picked Lamia up, one-handed, and brought her face close to his.
"Go near him again, you or any of the Velvet Children, and I'll come by day to your cavern while you sleep, and I'll burn it to the ground. Understand?"
She nodded. He let go of her, and she dropped to the floor. Then she pulled herself up to her full size, which was not terribly tall, threw back her head and spat hard into the Marquis's face. Lamia picked up the front of her black velvet dress and ran up the slope and away, her footsteps echoing through the winding rock path of Down Street, while her ice-cold spittle ran down the Marquis's cheek. He wiped it away with the back of his hand.
"She was going to kill me,"
stammered Richard.
"Not immediately,"
said the Marquis dismissively.
"You would have died eventually, though, when she finished eating your life."
Richard stared at the Marquis. His skin was filthy, and he seemed ashen beneath the dark of his skin. His coat was gone. Instead, he wore an old blanket wrapped about his shoulders, like a poncho, with something bulky, Richard could not tell what, strapped beneath it. He was barefoot, and, in what Richard took to be some kind of bizarre fashion affectation, there was a discolored cloth wrapped all the way around his throat.
"We were looking for you," said Richard. "And now you've found me,"
croaked the Marquis, dryly.
"We were expecting to see you at the market."
"Yes, well, some people thought I was dead. I was forced to keep a low profile."
Why did some people think you were dead?"
The Marquis looked at Richard with eyes that had seen too much and gone too far.
"Because they killed me,"
he said.
"Come on, the others can't be too far ahead."
Richard looked over the side of the park, across the central well. He could see Dor and Hunter across the well on the level below. They were looking around for him, he assumed. He called to them, shouted and waved, but the sound did not carry. The Marquis laid a hand upon Richard's arm.
"Look,"
he said. He pointed to the level beneath Dor and Hunter. Something moved. Richard squinted. He could make out two figures standing in the shadows.
"Croup and Vandemar," said the Marquis. "It's a trap."
"What do we do?"
"Run," said the Marquis. "Warn them.
I can't run yet.
Go, damn you."
And Richard ran. He ran as fast as he could, as hard as he could, down the sloping stone road under the world. He felt a sudden stabbing pain in his chest, a stitch, and he pushed himself on, and still he ran. He turned a corner, and he saw them all.
"Hunter! Door!" he gasped, breathless. "Stop! Watch out!"
Door turned. Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandermeer stepped out from behind a pillar. Mr. Vandermeer yanked Door's hands behind her back and bound them in one movement with a nylon strip. Mr. Krupp was holding something long and thin in a brown cloth cover, like the kind Richard's father had used to carry his fishing rods in. Hunter stood there, her mouth open. Richard shouted,
"Hunter! Quickly!"
She nodded, spun around, and kicked out one foot in a smooth, almost balletic motion. Her foot caught Richard squarely in the stomach. He fell to the floor several feet away, winded and breathless and hurt.
"Hunter?"
he gasped. "I'm afraid so," said Hunter, and she turned away. Richard felt sick and saddened. The betrayal hurt him as much as the blow. Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandermeer ignored Richard and Hunter entirely. Mr. Vandermeer was trussing Dor's arms, while Mr. Krupp stood and watched.
"Don't think of us as murderers and cutthroats, miss,"
Mr. Krupp was saying conversationally.
"Think of us as an escort service."
"Only without the bosoms," said Mr. Vandermeer.
He sounded ever so slightly embarrassed. Mr. Krupp turned to Mr. Vandermeer.
"Escort in the sense of accompany, Mr. Vandermeer. Ensure our fair lady gets where she's going in safety. I am comparing you neither to a lady of the evening nor to a common street harlot."
Mr. Vandermeer was unmollified. "Said we were an escort service," he muttered. "Know what that is?"
"Strike it from the record, Mr. Vandermeer. I misspoke myself. Let us from henceforth be chaperones, guards, accompanists."
Mr. Vandermeer scratched his nose with a raven skull ring.
"All right," he said.
Hunter stood beside the rock face, looking at none of them. And Richard lay on the rock floor and writhed and tried somehow to suck air back into his lungs. Mr. Krupp turned back to Door and smiled, showing many teeth.
"You see, Lady Door, we are going to make sure you get safely to your destination."
Door ignored him. "Hunter," she called, "what's happening?" Hunter did not move, nor did she answer. Mr. Krupp beamed proudly.
"Before Hunter agreed to work for you, she agreed to work for our principal, taking care of you."
"We told you," crowed Mr. Vandermeer. "We told you one of you was a traitor."
He threw back his head and howled like a wolf. "I thought you were talking about the Marquis," said Door. Mr. Krupp scratched his head of orange hair theatrically.
"Talking of the Marquis, I wonder where he is. He's a bit late, isn't he, Mr. Vandermeer?"
"Very late indeed, Mr. Krupp. As late as he possibly could be."
Mr. Krupp coughed sententiously and delivered his punchline.
"Then from now on, we'll have to call him the late Marquis de Carabas. I'm afraid he's ever so slightly..."
"Dead as a doornail," finished Mr. Vandermeer.
Richard finally managed to get enough air into his lungs to gasp, "You traitorous bitch!" Hunter glanced at the ground.
"No hard feelings," she whispered.
"The key you obtained from the Blackfriars," said Mr. Krupp to Door. "Who has it?"
I do, gasped Richard. You can search me if you like. Look.
He fumbled in his pockets, noticing something hard and unfamiliar in his back pocket, but there was no time to investigate that now, and he pulled out the front door key of his old flat. He dragged himself to his feet and staggered over to Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar.